You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Hey guys, this is Deep Tran, associate editor of American Theater Magazine and producer of the Offscript podcast. This month, American Theater is proud to present an all-new podcast called Three on the Aisle. It is going to be a fascinating and hopefully sometimes divisive conversation between three theater critics: Elizabeth Vincentelli of the New York Times, Peter Marks of the Washington Post, and Terry Teachout of the Wall Street Journal. They will be discussing theater in New York and nationally, and there might be some surprise guests. This new podcast will appear monthly, and you will soon be able to subscribe to it on Stitcher, iTunes, and Google Play. But in the meantime, we are going to make the first episode available for you right now on our Offscript feed. And if you like it, check back later in your preferred podcast platform for the official Three on the Aisle podcast feed. Enjoy this pilot episode of this all-new podcast, and thank you for listening.
I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli.
I'm Peter Marks.
And I'm Terry Teachout.
Welcome to the first episode of Three on the Aisle, a podcast from New York about theater in America.
We're hosted by American Theater Magazine, a publication of Theater Communications Group. Today and in future episodes, we'll be looking at and commenting on shows and trends from coast to coast.
All three of us are based in New York, but we're interested, of course, in theater everywhere. I write about theater for the Washington Post, where I've been the critic for 15 years.
I cover regional theater throughout America, as well as shows on and off Broadway for the Wall Street Journal.
I contribute to a variety of publications, such as the New York Times, the New Yorker, and Newsday.
Like most critics, we have strong opinions.
No kidding.
Which you'll all discover, and we tend not to agree with each other, especially. That's why we've teamed up to do Three on the Aisle.
We're not afraid to argue, and we don't get bent out of shape when we do.
Actually, that's what we like best. We love arguing, and we discover we don't agree on almost anything. But we just won't be talking about the plays we've seen. In future episodes, we're going to talk about theater artists from around the country and possibly even around the world. And we'll have them join us in talking about their work.
Yeah, like we're saying, we're interested in theater all over the place, all over America, not just in New York. We think you feel the same way. And I, of course, have a special interest in Washington. And we mean for Three on the Aisle to reflect that wide interest.
The point is, this is not going to be a show about three critics sitting in a room swapping "here's what I saw last week" opinions. There will be some of that. But we're even more interested in engaging with issues that are shaping the American theater scene right now.
And among the topics we're looking forward to discussing are, for instance, the rise of women director. And this fall, for instance, there are so many shows directed by women in New York. It is absolutely staggering. Among the other things we'll be talking about are, for instance, how do you make a living in regional theater as an actor or as a writer or as a technician?
We want to see if we can get some people to tell us the nuts and bolts of making a living out there.
Yeah, and Terry, Elizabeth, and I also want to take a closer look at issues like diversity in American theater, such a hot topic, both on stage and off. Where do things stand now? And the bigger question, where do we go from here?
Like they say in the infomercials, all this and more on Three on the Aisle. But first, we're new to podcasting, and we're probably new to many, maybe even most of you as well. So we thought it might be a good idea to start off by talking briefly about ourselves, about what we look for when we're reviewing shows, and maybe about a specific show from the past that sums up the kind of theater each of us loves best. Elizabeth?
Well, there's no one show that encapsulates everything I like. I love the biggest, gaudiest Broadway spectacle, and I love the very tiny off Broadway. But I would pick two that I think really signal what I enjoy. I'm going to say that my favorite streetcar production that I've seen, and I've seen a lot, is the one by Ivo van Hove. And I've already seen, I can feel the eyes rolling across the nation. But that is my favorite streetcar. aka the bathtub streetcar. And another show is something I saw this summer, actually. It was a little show done for 40 people at a time, about 40 or 60, in a not even a theater venue. It was a rehearsal studio, and it was called The Workshop. And it starred Austin Pendleton in a great performance as a kind of washed-up playwright. And it was directed, it was written by someone I'd never heard of called Tori Townsend. And for me, it was a wonderful show that was exactly what I look for in theater. It was a complete surprise. I had no idea what to expect. It was intimate, and it was just really thrilling to be there. And it's someone I'm looking forward to see more from again. So that's the two extremes, I would say.
Yeah. Peter?
Well, I've always thought of myself and described myself as a professional member of the audience. That's sort of what a journalist is. And what I guess what motivates me as a critic are the things that both excite me and look as if they'll last. One of those things is very ephemeral because it's what happens on the night we all go, and that's gone. But I also think at the same time you hold in your head or try to imagine whether or not this piece of art is going to have impact and relevance 1, 5, 10 years down the line, which is a much harder thing to pontificate
it's
on.
Tricky second-guessing posterity.
Yes, but I do think we have an obligation to put to find contexts of all kind. And so the show I would pick to sum up who I am as a theater goer, what I love, was one that I saw more than 30 years ago, Nicholas Nickleby, done by the Royal Shakespeare Company, which changed my life in a single day and has remained a model for me over the decades of the kinds of innovation, invention, and emotional impact that a theater piece can have and can stay with you in somewhere in your cerebral cortex your entire life.
Well, as for me, I'm thinking of what it says in the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm. My own prime directive is first don't be boring. Like Elizabeth, I want to be excited by the shows I see, which means that, like Peter, I want to be surprised by them. I don't need to see any more Shakespeare battle scenes where the soldiers wear berets and carry Uzis. At the same time, though, I also believe deeply in text-driven productions, shows that seek to illuminate what the playwright wrote instead of twisting it out of shape to satisfy some hotshot director's whim.
I'm talking about you, baby.
This is going to be great.
Yeah, these are the opposite.
This is going to be great.
I've reviewed more than 1,000 shows in the Wall Street Journal, and the one that I think exemplifies most fully what I'm talking about is David Cromer's revival of Our Town. Mm. Cromer directed the show that's on the page, not a made-up one in his head, but he charged Thornton Wilder's words with a poetry and an immediacy that made them sound completely fresh. You might call it poetic naturalism. That's my wheelhouse. So now that we've turned over our whole cards, let's spend a little time talking about a key trend, maybe the key trend, that's been driving an American theater and American theaters in 2017. In a word, Trump. How has the theater community responded to the Trump presidency, and has that response been good for theater in America?
I'm going to start by saying that I think the most, well, obviously the most Trumpian show of the summer was the Julius Caesar that the Public Theater did at Shakespeare in the Park.
It's certainly the one that got the most attention, not just here, but everywhere.
It got national attention, which is very rare for theater when it's not Hamilton.
Right.
I thought the production was really poor and misguided and misconceived. And talk about having a show that's in your head and not on the page. It made no logical sense. And I'm actually very much in favor of going out on a limb, but the limb has to have, this is a terrible mixed metaphor, the limb has to have an internal logic that works. And that show had no internal logic. It made no sense. But that said, I still think about it because a completely misguided show can often make you think, and you think about it over and over, and you're like, what went wrong there? Why didn't this work? Mm-hmm. How could they have tackled Trump, if that's what they wanted to say, with this particular play? I'm not sure. Maybe that was not... I think there's a French expression, it's fausse bonne idée. Means like something that looks good, but it sounds like a good idea, and it's not actually a good idea at all.
Hans Keller said, "When I hate something, I ask myself why I like it." I think that paradox might possibly be in play here.
I think this Julius Caesar Trump was so obvious that exactly is why it was wrong. Sometimes you have to be very suspicious of what looks so obvious that you have to do it. And this is a case of that.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of productions like that. We're going to see a lot more. At Hartford Stage, right around the same time as the Julius Caesar, I saw a revival of Heartbreak House, directed by Darko Trezniak, in which the businessman was dressed up to look like Trump. Mm. The rest of the production was right down the center, period, you know, the kind of Heartbreak House you expect to see. And, of course, he got a huge laugh on his entrance. How right. would he not?
Right.
But you were stuck with him for the rest of a rather right. long evening. And it was like having somebody walk into a party wearing a T-shirt with a very dirty word on the front of it. Everybody laughs, but you got to look at it for the next 2 hours.
Well, the problem is Trump is a one-dimensional figure. I mean, he's created himself that way. That doesn't work particularly well in theater. I think what you're seeing in these initial productions, and they're going to keep coming, because on Broadway this fall, you're going to have Bo Willimon's play, The Parisian Woman, which he's talking about revising weekly based on what's going on in Trump land. And you're having Tony Kushner talking about the fact that his next play is going to examine Trump. But what you're seeing is a very visceral, emotional response by the theater and feeling as if a counter-narrative, to use an overused term, has to be established early. I don't think it's created any great theater at this point.
It's created some horrendous theater. Robert Schenken's Building the Wall, possibly the worst play I've reviewed ever in the Wall Street Journal or my whole life.
No.
Nobody seems to have liked it.
That was so benign. Yeah. There is so much worse than that play.
In the moment, it was agony. But I'll tell you something else, though, that is easy not to talk about. Because, as I think we'll all admit, theater is pretty much monoculture. You're not going to run into a whole lot of people making theater who, let's not even just say like Donald Trump, but find him tolerable, feel any common ground with him at all.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, that is not necessarily true of the audience. I've been talking to, and I don't want to name any names, some regional theater artistic directors who are telling me that their donors don't all feel this way.
Hmm.
It's a big world out there, and it's not true that everybody in it voted for Mrs. Clinton or thinks that Donald Trump is the Antichrist. And what I'm not seeing in the Trump theater that I've seen so far is, let's call it, the responsibility to persuade. The thing that Shaw was always great about this. He always gave his villains, he gave the devil his due.
Hmm.
The villains got all the best lines. I don't see anybody who's willing to do anything other than demonize Trump and the very idea of Trump. And no matter how you feel about him, I don't think that makes for good theater.
I think, though, that what we're seeing is a response still to the campaign.
Yeah.
That is what we're seeing. Nothing has happened in this administration of any substance to really chew over. What's interesting, if you look at two plays that I've seen recently that were basically written, you know, I don't know, pre-Trump or when Trump was sort of germinating, were Skeleton Crew by Dominic Morisseau and Sweat by Lynn Nottage,
right.
Both of which one could say express more than almost any other plays the sensibilities of working class people. Not in a necessarily political way, but they are talking to the issues that we think of as the Rust Belt's concerns that led to Trump,
right?
Which is interesting.
I mean, Sweat completely predates Trump.
Right.
He makes no reference.
But that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, we're going to see productions of Shakespeare that are going to reference Trump for the next 8 years. I mean, or 4 years, or however long we're going
to
be with him.
The problem is that you don't have to do that. And political self-proclaimed political theater is usually terrible because
right.
it tells the audience what to think. The audience does the job on its own. Almost any play can become political because of context.
Right.
Not any play, but a lot of plays
sure.
can.
Right. And what you bring into the theater in yourself.
It's what happens around you. It's how you feel. So it could be the example. I mean, you don't have to make a businessman in a Heartbreak House look like Trump.
Right, a long red tie.
The audience can project that on their own without seeing it and being force-fed that idea.
I think it's kind of condescending to the audience. I have a particular dislike for what I call applause sign theater. where you can just see that sign flashing over the proscenium, and you get the robotic laughter or the
preaching
robotic
to
applause.
The choir.
I only like it when there's a huge kick line, basically.
Yeah, if it's funny,
if it's hello, Dolly.
Yeah, if it's funny,
if it's
funny,
a big number.
Yeah,
but you know, there's a difference between what we're seeing now and what we consider protest art, which has a great underground tradition in many cultures. I don't think what we're seeing so far can be labeled that. It's really sort of, you know, just sort of purging art. And I don't know.
That's a good way to put it.
So something is going to change down the line. I also think one of the most interesting ways we may see alternative art emerge from this period is not going to be in the messages, which I hate, you know, and I hate a play with a message usually. It's not going to be in necessarily coming from the traditional voices that we expect to have political points of view. It's going to be from perhaps a wave of artists who are going to suddenly be recognized as having a different point of view. Artists of color, Latinos, Blacks, Asians, that may be the essential voice of resistance
but becomes
something really new and vital.
But we're going to run into a problem, and I think that's something we will talk about in a future podcast, is I think we're having now a pipeline for playwright, which is pretty much MFAs, which creates this kind of cookie-cutter playwrights that's erasing any kind of different voice. I have a huge problem with that. You can be anyone, but if you've gone to Yale Drama, I'm sorry, your voice has been formatted a certain way. And I think we're losing that, and that's why we're getting those cookie-cutter protest plays that are completely non-interesting.
Something else. We no longer really have what I call a fame mechanism in American theater. It used to be, 20 years ago, that a playwright could actually become well-known to the culture at large. And they didn't have to do it by coming up through any conventional channel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are a lot of new plays being done out in regionals, all over the place. But how do we find out about them? How do they become known outside Florida, outside Nevada,
Do you feel like, let's say, in New York, the literary managers, the artistic directors are not doing their work of checking out? Like, do you think they're waiting for the work to come to them, which creates, again, enhances this cookie-cutter effect?
There's a lot of that. I mean, it's just, it's hard. It's a big country.
Right.
There aren't a lot of people traveling around in
right.
it. How would you hear about a play if it isn't already on a conveyor belt, if it's not a co-pro with multiple companies, if it doesn't make it to Off-Broadway? I mean, there are some conventional channels for getting in the sites, but they've mostly dried up because of this lack of national coverage. And even I, when I go out there to the regionals, I'm not as likely to review new plays as I am revivals, because if I'm going to a company whose work I don't know, I want to see something that I do know, so I'll have a benchmark to work with.
Well,
so
if you
I'm
look,
part of the problem, too.
Yeah, well, I mean, and if we're going down that road, you know, the problem of Broadway is that plays have been on the largest platform, whether or not you think Broadway is the place that defines American theater. The platform has been reduced to the point where you get a couple of commercial plays a year, which don't make money unless they've got a big star. I mean, we're talking about a world in which so the audiences for any particular work are so small that the breakout opportunity only comes along once a decade, a la Hamilton.
Yeah.
So there's no place to share these things except on a podcast like Three on the Isle.
Elizabeth, let's pull the camera back a little bit. Tell us a political play that you think does work as drama, as a political statement, that it's a show you were glad you saw and that you'd want to see again.
You mean of recent vintage?
No, any political play. I mean, not Shaw, obviously, but you know something in the last half century.
A lot of the stuff that I would think of as a political play is not defined as a political play. It's what I see in it.
Uh-huh.
Because it makes me rethink my relationship to the society around me. So it's not necessarily... It can be little things like, for instance, I think, it, just off the top of my head, there's a young director I quite like called Lear de Bessonnet. I hope I pronounced her name wrong.
You sure did, and I worship Lear.
Well, what's interesting about her, for instance, in her casting, she has this really very generous and open-minded ideas about casting. For instance, she will she often mixes not just races but ages. She likes using older actors. Her Good Person of Sichuan was very, very typical of her approach. I thought that was a wonderful show.
And
that
to me, the Brecht play at the Public Theater.
Yes, that to me was a political play. With that, I mean, of course, the material is already Brecht. So,
the way it was done
was incredibly audience friendly, I would say, and it has a way to suck you in without really hitting you over the head with it. And a lot of it has to do with her approach to casting. The thing with Lear's approach, I mean, it completely backfired in her recent Midsummer Night's Dream at Shakespeare in the Park, which was completely skidding out of control with actors letting loose. And there was no, you felt there was nobody holding the reins there. It was people left to their own devices, and it was a total disaster. But in general, I think her approach to casting is very political with that thing. So it's just being very naturally that way. I would count that as political theater, even though people may not. But having a 90-year-old actor on stage playing a fairy is, it's saying you something in our ageist society.
Well, it sounds then, Elizabeth, like you see politics as a lens through which the work can be viewed.
Yes.
And
that's what, to me, it's all about context. And another year, I may not feel that way, but right now, because of the world we're in right now, it just feels that way.
Yeah, and my instinct is since I'm very work driven, is to look for a play that is itself political, but in a way that works for me. And to me, the paradigm is David Hare's Skylight, which is an intensely political
it's
play.
It's a beautiful play.
It is one in which the devil is given more than his due.
Mm.
And it works entirely as a work of theater, whether you agree with where it's headed or not. You could do it right at this moment and not shade a bit of it, and you'd get Trump out of it.
Well, I think that's an interesting point, and I think in terms of your Shavian sort of analysis, for me, a perfect political play was Clybourne Park, which for me did something of the same thing. I mean, and interestingly, you know, a political play doesn't have to mention a president. You know, it doesn't have to reference a partisan point of view.
It's better if it doesn't.
Exactly.
I think.
It takes the tenor of the time and distills it. And Clybourne Park did that in this wonderful way, in this bifurcated way, using both a classic piece of American drama, and then Bruce Norris projected it forward to now, and talking about the way we can't talk about these things.
I completely agree with that. That was such, it's a very good example, actually, of what
well,
I would
instead
consider
of lobbing water balloons at both of you over Clybourne Park.
Terry didn't like Clybourne
Park. Not even a tiny little bit. But let's move
away.
You looked
shocked when I said
Yeah, let's
Clybourne
move away
Park.
From this area and turn to maybe a happier topic. The fall season is about to get underway in New York and elsewhere. And I'd like to ask both of you the obvious question. What shows are you most looking forward to seeing between now and the end of 2017?
All right. I have two. The first one is a German production of Richard III. Talk about political. Bit on the nose, but...
Oh, is this Ostermeyer?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm interested in that.
Ostermeyer's, Thomas Ostermeyer's take on Richard III.
Where's that going up? At BAM?
It's going to be at BAM, okay. And it's starring Lars
that's
Eidinger.
That's the Brooklyn Academy of Music, everybody.
Yes. Starring Lars Eidinger, who's he's a German, titan of German theater. He's a fantastic actor. I've only seen him twice, but he is, like, to be able to see him live is a rare thrill for us in the U.S. So just for that. And also Thomas Ostermeyer, interestingly, will be making his Broadway debut in the spring with the production of Enemy of the People, which is actually, it's a production we saw at BAM a few years ago, but this one will have a new adaptation by Brandon Jacobs Jenkins.
A play I would almost commit suicide in preference to seeing again.
Oh, really?
I really like that play.
Enemy of the People?
But, you know, I really think it's the weird thing play. Is it's going to be taken as a kind of lefty firebrand, but I think it's a profoundly Ayn Randian play.
Mm.
It's a really perverse play for lefties to like. It's completely insane. We can go back to that. But the last time the last time I saw it, I really had this. I was like, this is an Ayn Randian play. Mm. We can go back to that. So that's number one, Richard III at a BAM in October. And my second pick is SpongeBob SquarePants. You know, it's a new musical. Uh-huh. It's going to be on Broadway, and it's directed by
Tina Landau.
Tina Landau. It's a very odd choice.
Yes.
On paper, but then so was Julie Taymor when she did The Lion King.
Sure enough.
Everybody was like, it's a very odd choice. Who's that woman directing The Lion King? Well, I'm very much looking forward to SpongeBob for many reasons.
Is that because you're a SpongeBob fan?
No, not at all. Not at all. I've never seen SpongeBob.
Nor I. We may be the only two people in Manhattan who haven't.
I have no kids, so I've not been exposed to SpongeBob. But I like a big, crazy Broadway spectacle. Hmm. And this may be, it may be crazy in all the wrong ways. Hmm. I hope it'll be crazy in all the right ways. Hmm. But I think it's the kind of show where, in the right hands, a great Broadway show to me is one where you're surprised. Where you watch what's on stage and you think, what the hell is going on? What is that? How did they come up with that? Why would they think of that?
Mm-hmm. Do you remember
say that in the best way possible.
You remember Bill Murray's character in Tootsie? He's an avant-garde playwright. He's at a party and somebody comes up to him. He says the best compliment he ever got was when somebody came up to him and said, I saw your play, man. What happened?
I like those shows. Mm. I'm looking forward to that one.
Well, to follow in that along that thread, Elizabeth, and I'm going to let Terry steal probably the juiciest show of the fall, but I'm really looking forward in Washington to seeing the premiere of Mean Girls, the musical, because of the mind behind it, the comic mind behind it, Tina Fey coming to the theater. She loves the theater. She's doing the score with her husband, I believe. I don't know them. I'm going to watch the movie again. I remember Lindsay Lohan's performance, but I didn't think it was the most likely to be transformed into a musical. And we'll see what happens. But I'm excited that it's starting in Washington, and I'm excited to see how receptive she is to creating a piece that might need some work after its first stop.
That is a really good point. Is she willing to walk the walk?
Right. And the other piece that I'm really looking forward to is by Ayad Akhtar, who won a Pulitzer Prize for Disgraced.
Oh my God.
And
just, I have never liked a single play by him. He's so overrated.
Oh, there are two of us in agreement on something.
I think he's a great playwright.
I loved
Disgraced. And I am looking forward to a big play he's doing called Junk, which is, you know, asking for it, obviously, calling
that's
your play
Broadway,
Junk.
Right?
Talk
that's
about
Lincoln
ramming
Center,
stuff
Vivian
right
Beaumont.
Down your
it's,
throat.
It's following in Oslo's footsteps, in a sense. It's kind of a national theater written all over it production. But it's about Michael Milken, essentially, the junk bond king of the 80s. And I'm fascinated to see if this is a play that translates our times through those times.
As probably the only fan of Enron in this room,
I believe that you
say.
Were.
Yes, and now the upchucking is coming from my side of the room.
Well, as Peter foreshadowed, I share, I think, with both of you, the sense of prospective excitement about the Broadway transfer of The Band's Visit, which is finally moving uptown after a very successful off-Broadway run last year at the Atlantic Theater Company. It's a stage version of a movie about an Egyptian police band that ends up playing a concert in a small town in Israel by mistake. And it's got charm to burn. The adaptation is by Itamar Moses and David Yazbek. The director is my favorite, David Cromer. And Katrina Lenk, who is coming to Broadway with the show, mm-hmm. will be giving a performance that I have no doubt will be Tony-worthy. She is very special. I also want to put in...
I'm just going to say, the worry I have is, it's a critic's darling, this show. It did very well at the Atlantic. My only worry is, are we going to build an expectation? People are going to see the show. It's a jewel box show. It's a small piece. Are they expecting fireworks? And are we? Do we have to prepare an audience for the fact that that's a Broadway audience? That's not what they're going to get. Because remember, we still have 67% of the audience is tourists on Broadway.
It's a big danger. This is, I think, what happened to Hands on a Hard Body, a show that should not have gone to Broadway. I think it's a wonderful musical, but
I totally agree. I loved it.
It was not meant to be done in a large house. These are serious pros. I'm sure they're very aware of the problems they're facing in bringing the band's visit to a big house, but the problems are built in, and we're going to find out.
Right.
It's interesting that you say that we need to prepare people for that.
Well, because we love
it. I think that's a hell of a good point.
You know, every season there's a show or several shows where people say, oh, this shouldn't be on Broadway. And then every season there's a freak hit
that's true.
That comes in and
Fun
that execs come from away.
Come from away.
Come from away. Who would I would
right.
never
We'd be producers
have guessed.
If we could second guess this.
Yeah, right.
So I really don't think there's the whole idea of, is this really for Broadway? What is for Broadway is what works. And you
That's
never
true.
Know what's going to work.
That's true. What sells, sells. I also want to put in a word for Eric Tucker, whom I believe to be this country's most talented director of classical theater. Eric is moving out of his comfort zone with his next show for Bedlam Theater Company, the off-Broadway troupe that he leads. They're going to do Peter Pan in November. Not the Jerry Robbins version, but the original James Barry play. Eric's a kind of genius at making theatrical magic in grungy-looking black box performance spaces. I don't know what he's going to do with Peter Pan, but I can't imagine that it'll be anything other than amazing, and I better leave it at that. The clock says it's time for us to wrap things up. Not to worry, though. We will be back next month with another podcast. So until then, I'm Terry Teachout.
I'm Peter Marks.
And I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli, and you've been listening to Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America, hosted by American Theater Magazine, a publication of Theater Communications Group.
Our producer and engineer is the marvelous Deep Tran.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be seeing you on the Isle.